This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Wir sind zurück beim Spitzenspiel zwischen Einnahmen und Ausgaben. Es bleibt spannend. Gewinn perfekt vorbereitet von Rendite, aber Lohnnebenkosten bleibt gefährlich. Und jetzt kommt Umsatzsteuer aufs Feld. Gutschrift zu Bonus, Bonus. Und da taucht plötzlich Spesenerstattung auf. Schuss! Oh, in letzter Sekunde hält der Notgroschen.
Finanzen werden nie so spannend sein wie Fußball, aber wir geben unser Bestes. Konto, Geschäftskonto, Unternehmensgründung, Buchhaltung.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. We have 28 minutes to understand a big issue of the day and the top experts to help us. Better get on with it. In this edition, there are big ructions inside Scotland's governing party, the SNP. What's going on, and how does it affect the party's campaign for independence? The Scottish National Party has always been known for running a tight ship, but not anymore. This week, one of the party's most senior Westminster MPs, Joanna Cherry, wrote about it being in a state of unprecedented turmoil. And this, as the polls suggest, the SNP and its leader, Nicola Sturgeon, are ahead in the run-up to May's Scottish elections. Elections which could well decide if the Scottish Parliament will ask for another independence referendum. So this week, I want to understand what's going on inside the SNP and what effect it might have on the future of Scotland within the United Kingdom. Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. In some ways, this story begins in 2017. Joining me first in the briefing room to take a machete to the apparent jungle of complexity is Sarah Smith, the BBC Scotland editor. Sarah Smith, can you just remind us how close Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon were?
They were really close personal friends as well as political allies. And that's not always true, even with people in the same political party. But they were. I mean, he went out of his way to make sure that she succeeded him as the leader. And that's why this is particularly bizarre, that they are now such bitter enemies. It has become a very dramatic political soap opera that could have very significant consequences.
Right, let's break this down a little bit. He was the First Minister, and then there was the referendum, which was lost, not by a little bit, but by actually quite a bit in 2014. And he then stood down, and as you say, she was his successor. So when does it start to go wrong between them?
Well, allegations were made by two women who were working for the Scottish Government at the end of 2017. So this is after Alex Salmond has already left office in 2014. But the allegations relate to incidents they say happened when he was the First Minister. Now, at first, Nicola Sturgeon didn't know anything about this. She was informed about it in early 2018 because the investigation into this sexual harassment was conducted by civil servants under Scottish Government procedures. But right from the start, Alex Salmond was convinced, firstly, that the Scottish Government were applying their procedures completely wrongly and illegally. He took the Scottish Government to court and he won on that. He was able to prove in court that they had applied their procedure wrongly. But for months, he'd been asking Nicola Sturgeon to intervene in this process, to save the government from the embarrassment of losing a court case like that. And she refused to do so.
Now, you can't help noticing that 2017 is in the wake of the Me Too movement. Is it your reading that actually Nicola Sturgeon was responding to the mood of that moment in thinking that she shouldn't get involved in stopping any inquiry into accusations of that kind?
She's certainly linked this to the Me Too movement herself frequently and says that's why the Scottish Government had updated its sexual harassment policies. And it was that update that meant that you could bring complaints against ministers who had already left office. So previously, the fact that Alex Salmond was 3 years out of office would have meant that nothing could have been done. However, after that, Nicola Sturgeon had nothing to do with it. Or certainly, she absolutely maintains that she didn't get involved in any way because the procedure is quite clear that politicians have not to meddle in it. They're not even supposed to know an investigation is going on. This is handled purely by civil servants in order to make sure there can be no accusations of political interference.
The accusations against Salmond, there was the government investigation, and then there was a trial.
There was. He was accused of 13 counts of sexual assault against 9 women. There was a criminal trial in which he was acquitted of all those charges. His acquittal happened on the very day that the UK went into lockdown in March last year. And he gave a statement outside the court saying the time will come when the whole story behind all of this will come out, but that time is not now because of the pandemic. And it seems that that time may be now in 2021 that we are finally going to hear what everybody thinks went on behind the scenes and whether or not there was any wrongdoing by anybody.
So we've now got, how many inquiries have we now got into what happened?
We've got two separate inquiries which are looking at two slightly different things. There is a Holyrood Parliamentary Committee that's made up of MSPs from all parties, and they're looking at how the Scottish Government botched the original investigation into the sexual harassment charges, the investigation that ended up being found unlawful in court. So really, it's civil service procedures that they're looking at. Nobody thinks Nicola Sturgeon is to blame for the mess that was made of that original investigation. But because this inquiry is hearing from witnesses in public, they're often Zoom virtual meetings, but we're all able to watch them online. And they are asking witnesses all sorts of questions that have the potential to produce embarrassment for Nicola Sturgeon. And she herself will be appearing in front of them on Tuesday when she says she is looking forward to giving her version of events at length and that they will find that she's done nothing wrong at all. Now, there's an entirely separate inquiry headed up by James Hamilton QC, and that's looking at whether Nicola Sturgeon breached any of the government rules. She referred herself to him because she says that she didn't mislead Parliament in any way, that she didn't breach the ministerial code in any way, and she wants him to investigate that and says she'll be found entirely innocent. Now, of course, that's not necessarily the outcome of that inquiry, and it's James Hamilton's investigation that has the real jeopardy for Nicola Sturgeon. Because if he finds that she misled the Scottish Parliament at all in anything that she said to them, or whether she broke any of the rules that govern how ministers are supposed to behave, then she would be expected to resign as the First Minister and as the SNP leader. So the stakes for her in this are incredibly high.
How prescriptive is the ministerial code? Does it say if you break it, you've got to go?
It says that anybody who is found to be in breach of the ministerial code would be expected to resign. So it's not a legal obligation to do so, but there would be a very, very high expectation. And Nicola Sturgeon is somebody who has always talked about upholding very high standards in public life. So it would be quite surprising if she was to try and brazen this out.
In which case, we better understand what is the wrong thing that she either did do or didn't do that could bring her down.
Well, initially, she was asked to give a full account to the Scottish Parliament of what had happened and what her involvement was. And she said very clearly the first she knew about this was when Alex Salmond came to her house on the 2nd of April 2018 to tell her about the investigation. Well, subsequently, it turns out that actually she did have a meeting with his former chief of staff in the Holyrood Parliament 4 days earlier. So there's a question about whether or not she told the whole truth to the Scottish Parliament about what she knew and when. But there's also a question around this meeting that she had in her home with Alex Salmond and several other meetings and conversations she had with him. Were they government business or were they SNP party matters? If they were government business, they should have been officially recorded and the civil service should have been informed about it. If they were simply party meetings that she was taking in her capacity as the leader of the SNP, talking to another SNP politician, then there's no need for an official record. But people's accounts vary widely on exactly what the nature of those meetings was, and that would be a breach of the ministerial code if she didn't record a ministerial meeting, and would be something else that would probably require her resignation.
Now, there is an extra complexity here, isn't this? Because distinguishing in the case of Scottish politics and the SNP between what is a ministerial meeting and an SNP meeting in the case of Nicola Sturgeon is made even more complicated by the fact that her husband is the chief executive of the SNP.
Yes. And he has given evidence to the Holyrood inquiry twice. The first time he appeared in front of it, he said he thought that meeting was government business. He wasn't in the meeting. He came home whilst it was in process. And he says he never talked to his wife, to Nicola Sturgeon, about what happened because it was clearly government business. Well, she says, no, it was a party matter. And opposition politicians are demanding to know, why on earth would she not discuss a party matter with the chief executive of the party with whom she happens to share a marital home? And so it appears that his original evidence was actually conflicting with his wife's story about what happened. He appeared again this week and said, oh, it was just speculation on his part. What the nature of the meeting was, he never really knew.
OK, now, Alex Salmond himself was supposed to give evidence this week, wasn't he? But didn't.
He didn't because he is angry that the committee is refusing to publish some written evidence that he has submitted to them. Now, rather ironically, even though the committee won't and say they can't publish this evidence for legal reasons, we've all seen most of it because it's been published online. But he is adamant that unless that material is published and therefore can be referred to in the committee's final report, he's not going to appear in front of them. So that seems to be the end of the matter for now. But Alex Salmond isn't trying to dodge giving evidence. He wants to tell his side of the story. He doesn't think he's got anything to hide. So even if he doesn't appear before this committee to give evidence under oath, I think it's highly possible that he will find some way of getting his side of the story out there.
Sarah Smith. So having established the recent causes of the rift between Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon, I want to know if there are other fault lines in the SNP. I'm joined by Danny Garavelli, a journalist who last year presented a documentary on Radio 4 called Scotland's Uncivil War. Danny Garavelli, we've heard from Sarah Smith about the events that led up to Alex Salmond's standing trial and being acquitted. In your view, is that when the rift with Nicola Sturgeon began?
No, it began a lot earlier. It goes really back to the aftermath of the 2014 referendum defeat. So up until then, they'd enjoyed a really close relationship, despite their very different personalities, but they had formed a really effective team. And it was a kind of a relationship that was forged way back in 1990, at a point when Alex was standing for leader for the first time. And Nicola was only 20 then, but she kind of delivered the youth vote. And from then on, he became her mentor, supporting her as she kind of worked her way through the party. And then I suppose you'd say there was a little bit of tension maybe around 2004. And at that point, the role of party leader had come up for grabs again. And Alex had said he had no intention of standing. So Nicola had put her hat in the ring. And then he changed his mind. And of course, that was a source of annoyance to her. But that was glossed over quite quickly because they decided to stand on a joint ticket with her as deputy leader and him as leader. And then after that, they were quite bonded and formed a really effective team. And she was effectively his anointed successor.
So what happens next?
So then you can kind of fast forward to 2014 and the defeat. So Salmond stands down. Sturgeon, as advertised, takes over quite seamlessly. And then I suppose what you'd expect to happen at that time would be like there would be a kind of post-referendum lull. But instead, there's a surge in support. Membership goes through the roof. She's suddenly hugely popular. I mean, there was a point at which she had a kind of rock star status almost. She was like appearing in front of vast crowds of saltire waving fans. of course, at that point, he becomes resentful. And to a certain extent, you can understand that because he's the man who's taken the party from the fringes to the mainstream. He's turned the party from a punchline to a major political force. And he looks at her success and thinks it's his success. And he really wants to be part of it.
So what does Alex Salmond do?
At that point, I suppose he could have carved himself out a role as elder statesman, but that's not what he does. What he does is he stands in the 2015 general election to be an MP. He gets elected. And he then becomes kind of unaccountably a thorn in her side. He starts extemporising on strategy until a point where he has to be told to desist. And then it gets even worse when he loses his seat in 2017 because relegated to the sidelines, he sort of recasts himself as a Bonnie Prince Charlie figure. And then he gathers all these like-minded diehards around him into a camp, sort of the kinds of people that would be for independence sake and would probably be white middle-class men like himself. And he just consistently undermines Sturgeon at this point.
So what does he do?
I suppose his pièce de résistance is when he decides to become a chat show host with Russia Today, now RT. You know, it horrified people, really, and it alienated some of his mainstream supporters within the party.
So had this become mostly a personal feud, I mean, about personal resentments?
I think it's more complicated than it just being personal, although the personal feud is at the core of it. I mean, I suppose the best explanation maybe is to look at it as if there's three fault lines. There's the personal fault line, the political fault line, and there's a cultural fault line. The political one is a divide over the approach to independence, and that's sort of a rerun of the gradualist versus fundamentalist argument, but this time Salmond's in the fundamentalist wing, if that makes sense.
So he comes out of 2014 saying, let's go for it again as soon as possible. And Nicola Sturgeon is saying, let's be more careful and build up support. Is that broadly it?
Yes, that's exactly right. She doesn't believe there's any point in holding a referendum until it's clear they can secure a convincing winning. So her approach is to try and win over soft no's to yes by demonstrating efficient devolved government. Whereas there are other people in the party who ally themselves to Salmond who are just too impatient. They think she hasn't capitalised on her popularity to deliver an independence referendum as quickly as she could and that she's massively too cautious.
And one of their problems, presumably, is that they think she's being too cautious, but she's also immensely popular.
Yes, absolutely. But that doesn't seem to stop them in any way. I mean, it is a problem for them, definitely, but they continue in their attempt to undermine her, really. And it all manifests itself in this kind of row over Plan B, which is an attempt to find a mechanism by which you could hold a referendum without the consent of Westminster. But Sturgeon's always been very much against that because she wants to have a Scotland within the European Union. And unless you can deliver a referendum that is perceived as legitimate internationally, then it's really not worth anything at all.
And this is really interesting. I imagine Plan B is something like what the Catalans did, which was to hold their own referendum, which the UK government wouldn't recognise. And so the Salmond people are saying, you should do this. And the Sturgeon people are saying, no, we shouldn't.
Yes, that's exactly it.
OK, now, we move it on a bit and we've had this week the sight of one of the most well-known Scottish members of the Westminster Parliament, Joanna Cherry, and her statement that the party is now in turmoil. And there's been a lot going on with her. Can you explain briefly what's happening there?
Yeah, well, you have to backtrack a little bit to look at the third fault line, which is the cultural one, which, as elsewhere in the world, is progressives versus populists. And the touchstone for that here, again, as elsewhere, has been transgender rights, and more specifically, the Scottish Government's Gender Recognition Act, which aims to make it easier for transgender people to gain a gender recognition certificate. Now, that split is not as absolute as the other ones. There is a crossover, but broadly, those who support Sturgeon support the Gender Recognition Act and those who support Salmond oppose it. And this row has just engulfed the party over the last few weeks to the point that one day there was a succession of resignation of younger members. And that concerned Sturgeon so much that she produced a video in which she restated her commitment to transgender rights. And that was a bit of a known situation for her because the pro-trans lobby think it's too little too late. And those who oppose the GRA think that she's just pandering to the woke contingent. And into the middle of that comes this issue with Jo Cherry, who was reshuffled off the front bench in Westminster. And that was a kind of an attempt to douse the flames, I guess, but it also probably, well, it possibly, arguably fanned them.
So this is a strange combination of attitudes towards independence and speed at which you might go, attitudes towards a major social issue such as transgender rights, and personal issues such as Joanna Cherry being a supporter of Salmond anyway. There's a paradox here, isn't it? I mean, you're looking at it from the outside, which is support for independence is at an all-time high, and yet at the same time, there's this bitter divide. How should we understand that?
Yeah, you've got the rise in support for independence being tied to Sturgeon's perceived competence in the handling of the pandemic. I mean, I was out in Linlithgow, which is Salmond's old stomping ground, a couple of months ago, and every single person I spoke to who had moved from no to yes cited not the SNP's track record, not Brexit, but Sturgeon's daily briefings, and equally importantly, how much they disliked Johnson's approach. So you've got all that going on. And yet at the same time, she's under constant pressure from factions of her own party and the wider movement.
Danny Garavelli. So what does the Scottish electorate make of all this? It's a pressing question because Scottish parliamentary elections are due in May, and Nicola Sturgeon has said the SNP will pledge to seek a new referendum on independence. Joining me now in the briefing room is Sir John Curtis, Professor of Politics at Strathclyde University. John Curtis, there are elections in May to the Holyrood Parliament. What do the polls suggest at the moment about how those elections will go? And how much credence do you think we should give them?
They all suggest that the SNP are a long way ahead. There are two votes that voters have in May, one for individual MSPs, one for party lists. On the first one, about 53% of the vote on average. On the second one, about 43-44. And if you take those numbers and trundle them through Scotland's proportional election system, probably at the moment the SNP heading for something like 70 seats in the 129-seat legislature. So an overall majority for the SNP alone of about 11. And none of the other parties are anywhere close to them. The Conservatives still seem to be second, probably a little bit above 20%. Labour Party third, probably a little bit below 20%. And in truth, the only real question, I think, about, but it's a crucial question, about the election in May is whether or not the SNP do indeed do well enough to get an overall majority on their own, and therefore they're back in the position that they enjoyed in 2011 when David Cameron was Prime Minister, or whether they don't manage to achieve that and they're again once more a minority administration as they are at the moment. Can we believe these polls? Well, the record of the polls in Scotland is no worse or no better than anywhere else. And given the size of the lead, certainly the prospect of any administration other than an SNP-led administration does seem very difficult to contemplate.
As far as you know, have these inquiries and the arguments about them had a big impact upon Scottish voters?
Not obviously so. Voters, when they've been asked, have demonstrated an awareness, rather more than half of them, indeed, you know, nearly two-thirds of them, certainly in response to one poll, said, yeah, look, I'm aware that there is this inquiry going on. But so far, at least, when we get to some of the questions that the polls start to ask, you know, do you believe Nicola Sturgeon or do you believe Alex Salmond, or, you know, what do you think about some of the particular things that have been central to the inquiry, you do get 30% or more saying, well, frankly, I don't know. So far, at least, no obvious sign that support for the SNP has gone down. Support for Nicola Sturgeon's popularity is not quite what it was, but that's probably to do because people's evaluations of her handling the pandemic isn't quite as sky high as it once was. Certainly a poll out this week suggests that, you know, support for the SNP is still running at around the 53% mark on the constituency vote that they've been running at before. The only thing we can pick up, you know, and again, it's really only in the last 10 days or so that this story's really begun to have more than inside page traction. You know, somewhat more people saying, well, you know, maybe the SNP are a bit disunited, though even there, the SNP is still regarded as more likely to be united than some of the other parties north of the border.
So it hasn't cut through in a big way yet, but there are signs that it might possibly cut through a bit more.
Almost inevitably now, the appearance of Nicola Sturgeon before the parliamentary inquiry next Tuesday, that clearly is a significant moment. We can expect it to get a lot of publicity. That's probably going to be the piece of political theatre at which this is going to come live. I think if public opinion is going to be shifted at all on this, then it's probably because of something that is said or done or found out that we didn't already know as a result of that appearance next week.
Nicola Sturgeon has made it clear that if the SNP does win a majority, then she is going to look to have a new referendum on independence. Does that make this a vote about independence? Or are a lot of people still going to be voting on, let's say, the way in which the Scottish government has handled the governments of Scotland?
It looks as though the election in May is going to be a quasi-referendum. And I say that because when you look at how those people say they would vote yes in a referendum on independence now, the polls suggest to us that about 90% of that group say they're going to vote for the SNP. And conversely, amongst those who now say they would currently vote no to independence, only around 9% say they vote for the SNP. And this is fundamentally different from the position when the SNP won an overall majority in the 2011 Scottish Parliament election. On that occasion, we know that nearly two-fifths of people who at that stage says, yes, I'm all in favour of devolution, but I'm not in favour of independence, voted for the SNP. And support for independence in the 2011 election was not particularly high at all. So the SNP victory in 2011 that led to the 2014 independence referendum was founded quite heavily on the support of people who actually weren't in favour of independence, though maybe in the subsequent 3 years, some of them changed their minds. The position now is not the same. The SNP is no longer dependent on the support of those who are opposed to independence. And at the same time, conversely, it's got pretty much the support of everybody who is in favour. So it looks as though, so far at least voting SNP is concerned, the central issue is going to be independence. And of course, behind that are arguments about the handling of the pandemic and about Brexit. But all of that seems to leave in the shade discussions about the wider competence of the Scottish government and the debates we were having about whether or not the attainment gap in Scotland between those from better off and less well off circumstances was being narrowed. You know, was the health service being run efficiently or not? Now, all of that, I think, almost inevitably has somewhat gone into the shade in the events of the last 12 months.
So what you're talking about essentially is a conflation, which is if you support independence, you're likely to want to believe and to believe that the Scottish government has handled things better than the UK government or than the authorities in Westminster and vice versa.
That's true, David. But one of the reasons why the pandemic matters and perhaps is much more important than the Salmond Inquiry, I mean, there has been a debate about how well the Scottish government has been rolling out the vaccine programme. And the UK government, of course, as the body that's responsible for procuring the vaccines, has certainly been trying to claim the credit. Now, the reason why that battle's going on is that we know that around one in five of those people who back in 2014 voted no say, you know what, well, maybe actually Scotland would have handled the pandemic better as an independent country. And that seems to have been responsible for some of the most recent increase in support for independence. So the crucial thing here is, sure, yes, most of the people who say that Scotland would have handled the pandemic better are people who voted yes, you know, 6 years, 7 years ago and have long been convinced. But it isn't just them. And that's one of the reasons why the pandemic is actually a crucial issue, you know, not simply because, obviously, above all, because of its public health implications, but also for the apparent impact it's had on people's evaluations of the merits of independence. And that, of course, is very much tied up with the perception that so far is held that Nicola Sturgeon has coped with the pandemic well and that Boris Johnson has not been so successful.
How closely identified is the person of Nicola Sturgeon with the potential success of a movement for independence?
Well, I put it slightly differently. It is quite difficult at the moment to conceive of a Scottish National Party that would be dominating, seemingly, the support of the Scottish electorate if Nicola Sturgeon were to be no longer with us. She's, as First Minister, the truth is she is remarkably popular and she has been front and centre of the Scottish government's voice and communications during the pandemic. I think many people would say that it's not obvious at the moment that there is anybody else, certainly current within the current Scottish Parliament, parliamentary SNP party, who look as though they will be able to fill the very substantial shoes that would be left behind if she were to depart the scene at some point between now and May. So given her popularity, her dominance, and given, as it were, there isn't an obvious successor, it would be a very substantial hole in the SNP retinue. And of course, if she were to go between now and May as a result of being brought down by this inquiry, then, you know, frankly, some of the pieces of the jigsaw in Scottish politics would be thrown up in the air. And none of us would be quite sure exactly how they would fall back down again.
John Curtis there, and my thanks to him, to Sarah Smith and Danny Garabelli. We're back at the same time next week. Until then, goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Tim Mansell, Sally Abrahams and Kirsty Knight. The sound engineer was James Beard and the editor, Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. There's our recent episode on what the attack on the Capitol in Washington might mean for American democracy. There's the one on whether there might soon be a referendum on the reunification of Ireland. And also the one about GameStop, the video games chain that briefly was worth as much as an airline. Mind you, how much is an airline worth these days?
Hi, I'm Zand van Tulleken.
And I'm Kimberly Wilson.
And just before you go, we wanted to quickly tell you about our podcast, Made of Stronger Stuff, from BBC Radio 4.
I'm a psychologist and Zand is a medical doctor, and we're bringing together our specialties to take a tour of the human body.
Each week we hone in on a specific body part, from the eyes and lungs to the appendix or the vagus nerve, and we ask how we can understand it better, ourselves more, and combine the body and mind to produce positive change.
So subscribe to Made of Stronger Stuff on BBC Sounds.